everybody. Before you start listening to this episode, I just wanted to mention a few things. One is that this is an episode about sexuality, and so listener discretion is advised. Also, at the beginning of the podcast, I had everybody introduce themselves and mention how long they were married, and I forgot to do that myself. John and I have been married for 14 and a half years. Enjoy the episode. Welcome to Mormon Expression. This is your host, Zilpha. Tonight we're going to be talking about a subject that's perhaps a little sensitive. It should be fun and interesting. We have a great panel assembled here. And I'd like you guys to introduce yourselves. And when you do, maybe mention your relationship to the church, just so if people don't know who you are. And then also, if you're married and how many years you've been married. I also want to note that there are four women here on this panel, and we're all heterosexual. So this is from a heterosexual woman's perspective. Chris.
Hi.
Welcome.
I hope you can hear me. my name is Chris Weber. I have been married, I will have been married 24 years this year. I have been formally out of the church for about a year. Prior to that, I was an active non-believer for about 7 years.
Wow.
So I'm a little bit far away from it, but I have a very good memory, and I was a young women's president for a while there in my active years.
And so did you grow up in the church?
I grew up very much in the church. Very, very active, very hold to the rod type of a believer.
Great. Thanks, Chris. Robin, how about you?
My name is Robin, and my relationship to the church is I have not stepped foot in my chapel for 3.5 years, so I consider myself a former Mormon. Recently, I have embraced my own label of secular Mormon. And that fits me very well nicely. I've been married for 15 years. I was raised in the church in Utah. Stories of pioneers, all that stuff.
Great. And Jessica?
Hi, I'm Jessica. I was born and raised LDS outside of Utah. I've been married for 16 years. And I stopped going to church about 10 months ago and haven't been back.
Wow. Great. Well, thank you all for being here and being willing to talk about the issue of LDS women's views and issues concerning sex and marriage. Before we get started with the discussion, just wanted to kind of set the stage by talking about how complicated the issue of sex is, and especially in our American culture. There are a lot of things that people have a hard time dealing with. They have a lot of boundaries, a lot of walls, and it makes it complicated. Then you add on top of that a strong religion. That makes it more complicated. And Mormonism, I think, in issues of sex and marriage, complicates things even more. So that is what we're going to be discussing tonight, how Mormonism has affected us personally and those we know, and the general experiences of women and their sexuality. And let's start with the teachings that we were taught as children. And these can be explicit teachings or maybe just that we soaked up as part of the Mormon culture that we were part of. Does anybody want to get us started with something that you were taught as a youth about sex or marriage?
I can start, I guess. I came from a very Orthodox family environment. I was the 7th of 9 children. And by the time I came along, you'd think my parents would relax a little bit with regards to sexuality or intimacy, but no, that was not the case. And I do not recall ever seeing my parents in any state of undress. It just didn't happen. I remember I saw my mom's garments once, and that was the extent of any type of natural intimacy that occurred in the home. My mother refused to sign the little, authorization slip so that I could talk about maturation at school, because she felt like it was something that needed to be taught by her at home.
Or
but
the
I
church.
Did not. Yeah. But I did not really get an education from her. I do recall that when I was about 12 or 13 years old and I was starting to mature my own body, and mom was not around, and we really didn't have that relationship, you know, where I could just start a natural conversation with my mom. So I started hitting, you know, like medical books and trying to figure out what was going on, very academically bent. So I was going to find the answers myself. And that was how I learned primarily about sex. I remember when I was about 14 years old, my mom gave me a little pamphlet, and I remember the instructions in it, or the explanation of sex was, your mother and your father, they love each other very much, and because they love each other, they will lay down by each other, and then there will be a child.
Magically.
That is a product of this, and this is how sex was described to me. And I mean, 2 years previously, I knew exactly what was going on. All the anatomical, you know, mm-hmm. parts and places and processes. And so it was kind of amusing at that point in time that mom was going to give that to me. And you'd think that with that many children in the home, they'd be a little bit more relaxed, but no.
Did you have older sisters?
I did have older sisters. I had three older sisters, but there was a 6-year gap between mm-hmm. me and them. And the only time I can remember even having a smidgen of sexual thought was once when my sister was a senior in college, and I stayed in her room one night, and I actually saw her remove her underclothes, and it was the first time I'd gotten a glimpse of a breast other than my own.
Gosh.
And so that was something that was memorable to me. I was like, wow, look at that. There is a female body part in real life.
You were never on the swim team.
I was never on the swim team.
No, I was not. So how about Robin?
Yes, well, that reminded me of a few things. In my family, I was the youngest of six, and I had three older sisters as well. The youngest besides me was 10 years older. So
wow.
Their high school or teenage years were very vivid to me. And we didn't talk about sex, which is one reason I've been so looking forward to taking part in this, because realizing I was silenced my entire life, and now I'm not, and that I'm willing to do that publicly. And so the messages I was given is it wasn't spoken about, but it seemed like it was everywhere. I remember being caught masturbating. I don't remember a time in my life that I didn't.
And really? So ever from a small child,
yes,
you discovered it?
Yes, definitely. And to where there was a story built around it that now I think is absolutely ludicrous. And I even know it's not true when I go and check years and dates and things. But I was told that a neighbor that lived across the street, another little toddler, you know, that when we were like 10 months old or so, we babysat, and she taught me to masturbate, and of course, she had been sexually abused, and only children who've been sexually abused touch their bodies. Anyway, so that was kind of the formative story I had, and I just...
But you don't remember any of that?
No, not at all.
You were just a little thing.
And in fact, it's not true, because my husband actually lived in that house, not that girl, when I was 10 months old. So I know for sure that... It didn't, if it happened at all, it didn't happen then. Mm-hmm. And by the time she moved in, I was well established.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, it was
so
everywhere.
When you say masturbate, are you referring to orgasm as well, or just the pleasure of masturbation?
I guess just the pleasure, because, you know, I don't think I even took my clothes off. It was just rubbing up against something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, or a blanket or whatever. It wasn't like really a big deal to me, because it didn't seem like a big deal. It seemed normal until I saw my parents' reactions, mm-hmm. you know. And I even remember at one point, one of my sisters, when she was getting ready to get married, you know, that I went up and got on her fiance's leg for him to bounce me, like play horsey. And mm-hmm. and I just got a real kick out of it. But at one point, everybody kind of, okay, enough of that.
Uh-huh. And you could tell that they thought you were getting more than a kick out of it.
Yeah, exactly. And not only that, at some point I became really the the butt of the family, because mm-hmm. not only, you know, being kind of, I felt shamed for it. Mm-hmm. And so I had no idea why until, I think about 7 years old, purely by accident, I tripped onto some porn in my home. And to see what was going on, and I finally went, oh, that's why it's a problem. Oh, that's what it's called. And so all of a sudden I linked, you know, what was very simple and pure to me to something that was very skewed. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't just, you know, your average Playboy, you know, it was really hardcore. So all of a sudden, you know, that became part of my identity. And I had no one I could talk to about it. Because you don't talk. My mom even found the magazine, so was well aware I had seen them. And the best advice she gave me, or the only thing she said after she was done crying her eyes out, was, it's not like that.
It's not like that. You mean she was referring to sex isn't like it was pictured in the magazine?
Yes, but she never clarified.
Huh. Mm. So when you became a teenager, did you were you active in the Young Women's at that time? And how did you respond to the teachings that you heard at church about sexuality? Or did
we
you
were
ever...
completely active, completely every Sunday going to church. It wasn't an option for people not to go.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember any teachings or specific lessons?
Well, just before I turned 16, and I looked it up in my journal just to, you know, reminisce and check my sources. And I found an illustration that I put in there of one of the, what would we call it?
Like a fireside?
Yes, a youth fireside, mm-hmm. basically laying out what's expected, I guess, sexually. And so part of my illustration, I plan for populating planets. And it was a fireside done by Gary Paul. And I think I sounded just like, you know, an automaton or...
Just kind of copying what he was
saying. Yeah, kind of very robotic. And
now, do you think that he asked you to take notes, or did you just take notes because you wanted to? Because I attended a similar thing with the same speaker, and I remember taking notes.
He may have asked us, because I remember that I had something to take home that I copied the visual mm-hmm. aid from.
Maybe there was a pamphlet or some sort of a
Yeah, there may something. Have been something with it. But the interesting thing is he had this thing about, like, drawing a heel. Mm-hmm. And these are the things that go up the hill. These are the things that go down the hill. And of course, up the hill ends with first kiss. Ends with first kiss.
That's all you get.
Well, yeah. And it's like, what is marriage when you kiss over the altar? I mean, that's when you can end at first kiss and still be considered okay. And then the down the hill, you know, light kissing, necking, light petting, heavy petting, all the way. And so this idea that was a pretty, the first kiss, like what's okay ending at first kiss, I think was kind of surprising. And the other part is there was something he said that I didn't write in my journal, but I remember vividly. And that was basically saying, and he was leaving it quite open, viewing porn, masturbating, although I'm sure he didn't call it that, you know, certain sexual things that happen that, you know, you may be able to repent and receive forgiveness, but you will never have the ability to experience sexuality the way God intended it.
Mm-hmm. Hmm.
So in that moment, I mean, going from like a 16-year-old and suddenly going, oh, shit.
You already messed up.
You know, it's beyond repair right. at this point. So, and I think that can really not be a good thing to take into marriage. And the other thing I wanted to add is I started my period at 10 years old before they'd even had the school maturation. And no one in my family ever talked about it. It was so secretive, and I'd been shamed so much about whatever I had tried to share that I hid my period for 1 to 2 years. I basically stole pads and tampons from my sisters.
Holy cow.
And so the only time my family found out is when I finally bled through and they had to come pick me up from school.
Good heavens.
Wow. Poor thing.
Anyway.
So it's kind of a very taboo subject in your family.
Yes. And in fact, I talked about it a lot more than anyone else did.
Well, let's go on to Jessica's early experiences. Mm.
Well,
or teachings that you remember.
Well, it's interesting to hear your stories. And I also was raised in a home where not going to church was not an option. We always went. We were very faithful. Sex was never discussed. Maturation was never discussed. I remember being afraid even to ask my mom if I could shave my legs. Like, I was so worked up over it and just nervous. And it's like I blurted it out and then I went and hid myself, you know? And then the next day I came home from school and there was a razor and a can of shaving cream sitting on my bed. And so things were just.
Wow.
And it was like, well, what do I do with this, you know? Okay. So I just
hope I don't cut myself.
Exactly. It's like, okay, I guess I'll figure it out. And that's sort of how it was with maturing and starting my period. And there was never a sex talk ever, not even like the real quickie right before I got married or anything like that. So,
wow.
I guess I wasn't taught a lot in the home about this kind of thing, but I did pick up on things at church. I mean, I made a whole list of things that were either actual things from lessons or things I kind of just sort of gleaned.
Well, let's hear them.
Okay. Well, the first on my list is multiply and replenish the earth. And to me, that means that there's a low expectation for pleasure. And I think this maybe was more important when I was younger, that sex is just for procreation, not for recreation. I remember hearing that. And since I grew up outside of Utah, that was something I sort of got teased about at school too. Like, oh, when you get married and when you have sex, it's not for fun. It's just to have babies. I remember
people
having
would
this,
say that.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yeah.
My gosh.
I still remember his name. But, to go along with that was sort of the expectation for to have a large family.
And that's what you saw in your future?
Yes. And I was sort of terrified of that because I wasn't the girl who always went and grabbed like somebody's baby at church to hold. I didn't really like to babysit. I was really kind of nervous about the whole baby thing. Mm-hmm. And there was a time I wasn't even sure that I wanted to have children. But then that just kind of goes along with what happens. It's like you go to college, you get married, you have a lot of babies, and you don't have any fun having sex. So that was the first thing on my list, multiply and replenish the earth. And so I do remember my husband and I, after we had our first two kids, we kind of looked at each other and said, well, we've replenished.
Are we done now?
How many more do we need to have to multiply?
Oh, yeah, the multiplication part.
Right. Okay, at least a couple more. So that's the first thing on my list. I don't know.
Yeah, why don't you pick a couple more that stand out to you as being significant?
Okay. The next one that sort of stands out is that sex is a duty once you're married. And again, that sort of takes away the pleasure aspect. I guess I just really was hung up on this fact that it's not for fun. Somehow that was reinforced to me.
So did you believe that? Or did you?
That's totally what I believed. I mean, gosh, it was sort of a bonus that it was fun.
So you thought that it could be fun, but just that's not what its purpose was.
Exactly.
I've got a quote from a prophet that says just that. Oh, the union of the sexes, husband and wife, and only husband and wife, was for the principal purpose of bringing children into the world. Sexual experiences were never intended by the Lord to be a mere plaything or merely mm-hmm. to satisfy passions and lusts.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I can kind of relate to that and thinking, okay, if that sounds reasonable. I mean, it kind of did. I had a friend when I was first married who was just a couple years older than me, but she'd been married like 3 years longer. So it seemed like forever much older than me. You know what I mean? And I remember her telling me that when she got married, her dad had told her, don't ever deny your husband or else, you know, meaning he'll go somewhere else to get his satisfaction. And so I just remember that just stuck in my head. Like, I can never tell my husband no. But of course, there were probably times that I did. And then I would just feel overwhelmed. Like, what have I done? I feel really guilty. Just.
Wow.
I think the sense of duty is heavily built in the way that they couch sexuality in general. You know, they speak in generalities about sex and intimacy and marriage and those types of things. And because of that, there is this default thought that, you know, you're the wife and this is a patriarchal organization, and out of that you do certain things out of a sense of duty. I spoke to a friend yesterday. I was asking her some questions about this. She's currently going through a divorce, and she when I first met her about 3 or 4 years ago, she had complained that she did not enjoy sex. They'd been married like 16-17 years and she'd never had an orgasm the whole time of her marriage. And I said, well, when we're talking about Mormons and sexuality, how would you describe it? And she said, well, Mormon husbands are poor lovers, is what she said. And then she said that she did not enjoy it at all. But if her husband did not have sex and there was an extended amount of time, he would get grumpy and he'd get rough with her and he'd be grumpy with the children. And so she said she would have sex with him and she called it taking it for the team, mm-hmm. is what she called.
Taking one for the team.
Yes. So that he would let up and wouldn't be so, you know, grumpy at home or, mm-hmm. you know, being bossy with the girls, so that they have several children and mm-hmm. That type of thing. That's how she characterized her sense of duty. I did read a recent book called Why Women Want Sex, and the sense of duty, coincidentally enough, is not necessarily bound to Mormonism. And a lot of right. women will do it out of a sense of duty or obligation.
Right. Well, it's interesting that there's so much expectation with sex. Like when you're in that, when you're old enough to get married and you're engaged and it's so forbidden, but you feel the desire and the passion. And then once you get married, it maybe it doesn't like totally meet up to your, how you built yes. it up in your head.
And I think the church complicates that by the kind of romanticism of marriage and yes. saying, you know, this is going to be forever mm-hmm. and you're going to have this romantic temple experience and the mirrors go on forever mm-hmm. and you're wearing all white and it's pure. And then you have this communion between you and your spouse and the Lord. And it's going to be this just spiritual,
like nirvana.
Yes, yes. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so I think when the church goes that direction, they set a lot of people up for huge disappointments. And, for one thing, a lot of, now Robin discovered it on her own. I discovered it on my own. I think it was about 12, but being able to pleasure myself taught me that sex could be pleasurable and should be pleasurable. But there are a lot of women who go and get married. They've never had an orgasm before. They don't even know how to have an orgasm. They don't know what a clitoris is. They don't know they have a clitoris. They don't know what it's for. But actually, before we get all the way into marriage, which is the second part of our discussion, I wanted to talk about how we viewed girls when we were teenagers, how we viewed girls who weren't on the straight and narrow. And what did they do? I'm thinking of even girls who would wear maybe short shorts mm-hmm. and sleeveless shirts. And I would think of them as slutty and just asking to be taken advantage of. And that if they got taken advantage of, that would be kind of, that's what they deserved.
It's
because they were
they
asking for it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that is definitely, you know, the culture at large as well.
Mm-hmm.
And Mormonism,
but emphasized with Mormonism because,
yeah.
I mean, not only are you not supposed to dress sexually, but you're also not supposed to show your shoulders. Those are sexual somehow.
Right. Don't know why.
you can't wear, you know, you're not supposed to wear clothes that your garments would show with, which, you know, covers your whole, the center of your body. So there's not a lot of play there as far as modesty goes. And also if, you know, if I saw a girl or I heard of a girl who had sex, I mean, her reputation was just blasted. I knew a girl in high school who had been dating this guy for months. I mean, they've been dating. And somehow it got out that they had had sex over the weekend. And the whole school knew. And it was horrible. It wasn't like she was just going around sleeping with everybody. It was her boyfriend for a long time, and they were in love. And I'm not saying that it's always a good thing to have sex before you're married, but the society at large and specifically in the church teaches us that if you have sex before you're married, you're a bad person.
You're a chewed up
damaged
piece of gum.
Yes,
a licked
cupcake, and the chewed up piece of gum. Now, who would want to have a chewed up piece of gum? And it's directed toward the women. It's not directed toward the men. It wasn't the men that everybody was talking about. It was her that everybody was talking about.
Definitely.
And and when you say something like in a lesson, and you give everybody cupcakes, except you show that, you know, you licked one, and who would want the licked cupcake? It's not a fair comparison to sex, because it makes it seem like if you have sex or do sexual things before you're married, that you're germy and filthy, dirty, and nasty.
And it balances out every other part of you and your character and those things.
Nothing else matters. Doesn't exactly matter that you're sweet and that you're fluffy.
Or smart.
or whatever. It's that you're licked.
Exactly. And that's one of the concerns I've had. As I've discussed this with some people, they mention, well, you know, the LDS church, they're so fair because they have the exact same expectation of the men as they do the women. And while recognizing, yes, it is perhaps more fair or less of a double standard, it's not good enough, because men, like you said, they don't get those lessons about the licked cupcakes.
Nope.
For sure. So, and the idea of staying chaste or whatever is one little part of their morality. They can be moral in so many more ways.
Exactly.
They can have the priesthood. They can do service. They can administer. I mean, there's so many things going on for them. Whereas women, it breaks down to the sole thing. What has happened to their vagina?
Right. In the lesson that I was taught when I was 12 or 13, because it's in that lesson manual, the quote was, Solomon said that the price of a virtuous woman is, quote, far above rubies. Young women, guard and protect your virtue as you would your very life. And they always use virtue and morality as meaning sexual purity. Even though those terms to the broader culture means so much more than just sexual, yes, purity. But that's what they meant to us.
And code words, because I remember morality, that was not, it had nothing to do in my world, or at least in young women's, with anything else but the code word for sexuality.
Right. Right. Yeah, because definitely, they didn't want to say sexuality. Although on occasion they would. And this is the section on chastity in True to the Faith. And this is what the church was asserting still. When people care for one another enough to keep the law of chastity, their love, trust, and commitment increase, resulting in greater happiness and unity. In contrast, relationships built on sexual immorality sour quickly. Those who engage in sexual immorality often feel fear, guilt, and shame. Bitterness, jealousy, and hatred soon replace any positive feelings that once existed in their relationship. Hmm. So they're basically telling us that if you end up having sex with someone you love before you marry them, that relationship is doomed. It will never survive that.
Oh.
Do you guys remember hearing that?
Yes, yes, most definitely.
Well, I especially like the whole veil of ignorance surrounding the topic in general. There is this great gigantic idea that we talked about a little while ago, where you're talking about this, you know, this is nirvana, this mm-hmm. is heaven, this is in the proclamation of the family, we declare the means by which mortal life is created to be divinely appointed. So we have all of these giant, you know, bigger, larger than life ideas that are floating in our head with nothing to ground them. There are no details except for negative ones. This is what you don't do. You only kiss once. And so both male and female in this environment, they have this idea of what it's supposed to be, but everything is red light. Mm-hmm. So, you know, how do you get from this environment where you've got this grand idea of divine sex, you know, that you're going to be having for eternity, with no idea of how to do it. And then you get married and bam, here you are, you without really any education, and without any type of guidance or direction. If your parents have taught you a little bit, well, then you're lucky. Otherwise, you're completely on your own. And then you're going to be learning from your husband.
Who doesn't know anything.
Doesn't know a thing either. So you fumble around in the dark for, you know, however long it takes till you figure it out. Mm-hmm. And we wonder why there are so many problems with women being sexually satisfied, and if they ever talk about it, it's a miracle.
Mm-hmm. One of my close friends confessed that after a whole year of marriage, she had not succeeded in achieving an orgasm, and she knew the word orgasm. She knew that she should be able to have an orgasm as a woman. She had no idea how to achieve that, because a lot of women are not capable of achieving orgasm without direct clitoral stimulation. Mm-hmm. If you don't even know you have a clitoris, you can't do that.
Back to some of the messages that I got in the Young Women's Program. I remember specifically one lesson I had where they sent home, you know, a little note card. You know, they'd always have some special little object or something they sent home to remind you about the lesson. And this particular card had on it in marker, "When you lose self-control, you lose your freedom and self-respect." Hmm. And not being able to lose control,
mm-hmm.
I think achieving orgasm as a married woman has a lot to do with losing control, trusting someone else,
exactly.
relaxing.
Mm-hmm. And that is something hard for, if you feel like you have to be in control at all times, and not only that, but that you have to include the Lord in the sexual experience. Because I have some really bizarre quotes from a women's conference that I'll have to bring up in a few minutes when you're done with your thought. But you can't relax. You can never achieve an orgasm in that kind of framework.
It's no wonder. No. It takes months, yeah. maybe even years for women to mentally adjust to the idea that they can actually be sexually satisfied for that reason alone. Because up until that point, it's all about having stops in place so that you don't go over the edge. You're not falling off and losing your soul to, you know, Satan and or whatever. There's all of these vague threats that are in place. And it's I can't even tell you how many couples I've known where the sexual problems, they show up immediately. And it's generally because the woman has no idea what's going on with her body. She's never masturbated. She doesn't know what's going on. She doesn't know what feels good. And so they have to stumble through this process. And hopefully she is lucky enough to be married to a man who has the patience to work with it. Because as we all know, men can orgasm a whole lot easier mm-hmm. than a female
right.
can.
If you don't mind me going
go
back,
ahead. Yeah, go ahead.
As far as that message we had in the lesson, I kind of remembered back, and I shared this experience with my husband and some of our friends recently, that I remembered a specific lesson. It was in the cultural hall, so it must have been combined. It seems like big stake people were there. They were talking about topics like this. I saw my best friend dissolving beside me, and all of a sudden having like a breakdown and running from the building. We had a huge grassy hill behind our church where we had a baseball diamond and just taking off and running and running. And I followed behind her. I don't recall if anyone else did, but I know at least I did. And that was the first time I had learned that she had been sexually active, perhaps even for years, and I wasn't aware. Because she was one that always I'd talk about, ooh, you know, kissing that boy. And she'd go, no, kissing's not okay.
Whoa.
And not only that, realizing her first experience, now recalling her description, was a rape by any intent and purpose. And it was when she was in ninth grade. And realizing almost our entire growing up years, she was seeing the bishop because she never could quite feel like she had repented enough. And very recently, within the last several years, there was a funeral. So I was able to see this friend again. And of course, very
it
active.
It wasn't her funeral.
No, not hers, but one that would bring her there. And actually very, very distraught, a family member of hers. And she's the most wonderful Mormon mother now. Many children, her very wonderful. And as we were leaving the funeral, my husband and I, we saw that bishop from our ward back when, you know, during that time. And I'd already left the church, so I pretty much kind of sat back and let him lead the discussion. And he said, oh, yeah, do you remember that friend of yours? Wow, she was sure wild. And I just, my eyes and my mouth, and I just sat there for a minute. And I said, you know what? That's not the way I remember it. And it got a little bit awkward, and he moved on to start talking about, oh, now he's a mission here, mission there, all the things he and his wife are doing,
well,
you know,
just
to further.
The fact that he brought that up was inappropriate.
And, exactly.
And I think that hopefully, I think the point of the story should be having sex before you're married is not a recipe for the disaster of the rest of your life.
Definitely.
She's living an adjusted adult life, and she survived it. And the church leaders would have us believe that that's not possible.
Yes, and why would he be talking to me about it this many years later? And I remember her telling me about some of the interviews and how detailed they were.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
that's
every
creepy
position, this and that, who orgasmed, who didn't.
That is the thing that just absolutely drives me crazy about this topic. I was on the church website today looking at their study guides for parents for teaching their children. And it was from ages 4 to 11 for one of them, and the other was 12 to 18. And in both of them, they said, if you're going to be teaching them about these things, use, you know, anatomical words, you know, be very clinical about it. This is me paraphrasing. They didn't use the word clinical, but they did say, don't personalize it. Don't talk about your sexual or your intimate life. In both of them, they did that. And so here we have, we're putting, you know, the bulk of these children's education on the parents. The parents are not to naturalize it at all. But if there's a problem, they're to go talk to an ecclesiastical leader and give them all the details.
Yes.
What's with that?
Oh.
Yeah.
Bad. Yeah, it's kind behind of closed doors with nobody else there. Right.
I lived in a world of arrested development. I did not have a television. I had no external source for which to get any information other than the non-information I was fed by my parents. And so when I was married, I basically had gone from this person who knew nothing about sex, which made me in that position where I was looking at these girls who were sexually active or who were breaking some of the rules, and I was absolutely judgmental against it. Sex was a foreign thing to me. There was definitely a partition between my conscious mind of saying, this is the way you're supposed to be doing it, and these gals are off the beaten track, and that I was absolutely looked down at them for that.
Mm-hmm. And what I wanted to hit on before we move on is partly one of the things that really sets us up for failure, and I believe women, and this is very general, you know, to our culture, but is also very specific to Mormonism, is very weak boundaries. Everyone in general, especially women, are taught very weak boundaries. You look outside yourself for validation, to know what's right, to know what's wrong, because your priesthood leaders know best.
When you say weak boundaries, do you mean...
Look, I noticed you said strong boundaries at the beginning, and I think I'm meaning it differently than that, because I think you meant strong boundaries more as places they won't go or even talk about.
Right.
And this, I mean weak personal boundaries, because basically, like how you should...
Autonomy.
Autonomy. You shouldn't... refuse callings, that someone has stewardship over you. Many people have stewardship
and they're
over
all
you.
Men.
They're men.
Except, of course, the Relief Society president or your visiting
but
teachers.
But they're under the men.
That's true. That's true. So, and then also, my husband was, we were talking about this, that when you're asked to school dances, you have to say yes, at least some families. You have to say yes to the first person who asks. It doesn't matter who it is.
I was
is.
Not taught that, luckily.
Oh, good, good. And then the idea of...
I mean, I probably should have, because I think I hurt a boy's feelings one time, and I didn't mean to. But I think I was blessed with some autonomy, and I think that came from my mom's kind of strong personality.
Yeah, and definitely. And this whole idea that you have to be nice, because of course, if you're direct and, you know, state what your boundaries are to a person and let them know, kind of manage expectations, well, then you're a bitch. And the idea of even since sexuality is your purpose, you have to market yourself to men based on how you look. So it's a really tight rope you walk because you... Yes.
Sexuality isn't really your purpose per se. It's your desirability from men. Like your ability to attract men, because you have to, in order to get to heaven, have a man.
Yes.
I mean, in the... I'm talking about the highest degrees of heaven.
So. Yeah, and so when I say sexuality, it's not only the ability to attract a man, but to please him after you're married and to have children. So your primary role is tied up in sexuality that way.
Mm-hmm.
But and so really, in some ways, you're saying, come here, come here, come here, but not too close. Or get away, get away, get away.
Right.
So.
Right. And I kind of wanted to add to the desirability comment that I always felt like you needed to be desirable, but you weren't allowed to really desire. I don't know.
Oh,
really?
That is so key. Oh, my heavens.
I don't know. I felt like that maybe wasn't feminine, or it wasn't in that nice category. Nice girls don't.
Yeah, that's true.
It was
it's a
cross boundary. Yeah. It's kind of like I was mentioning. You're basically in a state of arrested development. Mm-hmm. There is no natural evolving desire as you're
definitely
going through all of this process of becoming this, you know, wonderful virgin to this, you know, highly fulfilling role as wife and mother and all of these things. There's nothing natural about it. There are just jerks and stops and breaks and, you know, and you're not allowed to desire. That crosses into the realm of something that's not virtuous or holy or of good report.
So what about when you were engaged? Building up to our wedding day, how did we deal with our desires, or did we feel desire sexually for our fiance? Was that? I mean, I certainly did.
Oh yeah,
yes, yes, yeah. Definitely.
Oh,
definitely.
I remember thinking, I can't wait until I don't have to say goodnight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and part of it is that you want to be close to that person that you love.
Right.
It's not all about
S-E-X.
You know, yes.
It.
Right. But I mean, but there's so much more involved there, and the church wants you to keep hands off as much as possible before marriage. And my sister is engaged right now. She's going to get married soon. She's my youngest sister, and people are giving her the advice to not touch each other above the knee, to not kiss more than like a peck. They're engaged. They're going to get married in 3 months. How would that affect, like you were saying, the natural progression of their romantic relationship and their sexual relationship? It just seems so contrived and potentially harmful to their relationship.
I think I want to share something a little bit maybe in contrast, which is at the time I became engaged, I had been separate from the church. I hadn't really worked it out in my mind why. It just didn't fit with my life. You know, I was studying literature and feminist theory and was not part of the church. In fact, trying to be very separate from it. So I had had some experience coming into the relationship, whereas my partner was that pure, you know, return missionary. And even though active at the time, loved me for me. Oh my heavens, what is that like? And and in fact, he initiated, because very often I felt in control or that I needed to manage men's sexuality. So usually I was the one to put on the brakes, especially with someone that pure, mm-hmm. you know, to not destroy that for them. And so in this case, it was, you know, he was very interested. And I kept saying, okay, unless you want to cross that boundary, we need to have these rules. We need to go home at a certain time. We need to stop at a certain place. And he just seemed really baffled with that. And at some point saying, well, are you sure? Are you really, really sure? And kind of taking a chance with that. And now discussing how the months of our engagement, because we were already engaged at that point, but not married yet, were some of the most fascinating, most beautiful times that we shared together. And during the rough times of marriage, those memories really helped help us stick in there.
Well, you kind of followed the natural progression of the relationship. When you get to the point where you want to marry someone and you know that that's the person you want to be with every day for the rest of your life, hopefully, and then you all of a sudden go, whoa, we're not married yet. Put on the brakes for 5 months. It's just weird. And it makes it weird on the wedding night. Did anybody hear of or experience strangeness on their wedding nights?
I experienced strangeness leading up to the wedding night, since we're talking about this whole engagement period of time. We were engaged for 5 weeks. And if we would have been engaged for 5 weeks and one day, we would not have made it. And it was like when I got engaged, that was the cue. It was like a mental cue for me to say, oh, it's okay. I can relax. I can relax physically. I can do all of these things. And I discovered 3 weeks into our 5 week engagement that I could actually orgasm without stimulation.
Wow.
And I was so scared when it happened that I went to the bishop and talked to him about it. And I'd never gone to the bishop before, and I never had a sexual experience like that before. And my husband was going, what's going on? Because I was sobbing, you know, we were kissing, and this happened to me, and I was sobbing. And I went in and talked to the bishop, and he said, oh, you're so sensitive to the spirit, and blah, 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 blah.
He said it was the spiritual uh-huh. experience?
Oh, wow.
Okay.
Oh, that's interesting. Wow.
And so about a week before we were married, we were engaging in some pretty heavy petting, which is, I mean, we were at BYU at the time, and I was concerned about it. So I went to the bishop again, and he assured me that I was just fine. And I went in to get my temple recommend. And of course, the bishop said, you know, you're fine, you're good to go. Went into the stake president. The counselor there said, has anything not being cleared up? And I said, no, we had this, you know, me being so, you know,
this is very similar to what happened to us.
You know, I said, well, we had this one incident, you know, a couple of weeks ago, but it's all cleared up. And he said, well, what was it? And I started explaining. He started asking me questions.
Very
and
detailed.
Asking me questions. And over an hour. And at one point I knew that it was an inappropriate situation. He was asking me about the color of my underwear. He was asking me about the placement of my underwear. He was obsessed about whether or not it was off my thigh or it was down to my knee. And he was using this as a standard of measurement as to whether he was going to give me an interview so I could get married. And this was over an hour. And I was scared to death. I just knew that he was not going to give this temple recommend to me. And I kept on saying, I'm a virgin. You know, everything's been cleared up. And he just kept on grilling me and grilling me and grilling me. And according to him, if I was wearing black underwear, that indicated that I was trying to enticing. And so, you know, at one point in time, I just said, you know what, it was up here. And he gave me the temple recommend. I walked out the door and just sobbed. And my husband was sitting out there. Of course, his interview had been like 5 minutes long. And he's going, what is going on in there? And it was a pivotal experience for me because it taught me immediately, don't trust whatever this ecclesiastical leader is doing. And I think it helped me, to establish really, really healthy boundaries between me and my husband and whatever was going on or whatever was expected from the church at the time.
Almost exactly like our experience. And that was at BYU, right?
Yes.
That's exactly what happened to us. And, you know, and John was sitting out there just like your husband was. And he had answered the questions like the bishop had told him to. And I go in there and I feel like I have to be completely honest and bring it up. And then, you know, and then he brings John back in there. And John's the one he grilled for all of the gory details. They weren't that gory, but still, I mean, it was like, okay, it's John and I against the church, because we were in love and we were going to get married next week and we couldn't see what the big deal was, you know, why he was grilling John about this experience between fiancés. I mean, it did solidify John and I as, you know, a team. Mm-hmm. And I think it was,
yeah, it did the same good. Thing for
Useful
us too.
For
and it I was already feminist bent, you know, to where I'm going to do my thing, you know, regardless of what, you know, the priesthood leader is going to say. And that really solidified it for me. I'm not going to share with them anything. I'm a good person. I know I'm a good person. And whatever you were doing, you were the one that was crossing an inappropriate boundary. Mm-hmm. Looking back, I was 19 years old at the time.
Me too.
And I'm absolutely furious that I was put through that experience.
Yeah.
Because I was so innocent and I was just, you know, everything was all starry-eyed and I was traumatized beyond belief to go through that experience.
Well, it's interesting because I think we're taught something about like a sacred triangle, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where it's like you and your husband and the Lord. But somehow the Lord becomes like the church, and then the church becomes this ecclesiastical leader.
Right.
And it's like, my husband always says he felt like it was like a three-way, you know? It's like there's...
And not in the good way.
Yeah. No.
The divine threesome.
Right. It's like, you know, when we finally when we left and stopped going to church, he just felt like this relief is like, okay, no longer is the church, the Lord, the bishop, whoever. No, he's not in the bedroom anymore.
Mm-hmm. Well, and Robin was talking about learning how to relax. How much more difficult is it to learn how to relax if you feel that God is in your bedroom? I mean, really.
Right. And God is a voyeur. What a weird idea. You know, if you don't mind me adding sort of a contrast, it breaks my heart what you guys went through with your bishop. It's so crazy.
I never experienced that.
I was 23, and even though we didn't get married in the temple because I hadn't even been active in the church at all for, I don't know, a few years, or didn't even consider it, I should say. We didn't consider it. But because my fiancé had been so involved in the church to that point, and it was so important to his family, that we did go to see his bishop at one point. Just one, I don't know, it wasn't a very long interview, and basically said, you know, yeah, we've had sex and we're getting married and we're happy. We were perfectly fine getting married civilly. And he kind of said, well, are you sure? And he was very kind and he was very understanding, and really it didn't matter to us. So he actually performed our civil ceremony.
Wow.
Yeah.
So that was
anyway.
A good experience. And I think with both Chris and I, it was the stake people that were kind of
it
out
was.
Of
My
line.
Bishop
and the bishops
decent.
Were very understanding.